Thanks for downloading this podcast, which is for personal use only. All contents are copyright Radio Show Limited and must not be reproduced, rebroadcast, or used in any form without permission. For contact details, go to www.radiolemon.com. When we say live from the event, that's exactly what we mean. Our team of experts are at the track, pounding the paddock, patrolling the pits. More driver interviews, more insight, more information, more excitement. As it happens, it's live, it's here, RadioLeMans.com.
Hello there and welcome along to another Toyota Tech Talk. But instead of talking to an engineer, we're going to talk to a driver. Anthony Davidson is with me. I think it's fair to say, Anthony, you and I have spoken about this early part of the season. There's probably more now for you to do inside the cockpit than ever before. And that's aside from the driving side of things.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, certainly more so than when I first joined sports cars properly with the Peugeot team. Back in 2010, things have come on leaps and bounds in technology. I can't believe I'm at this stage in my career where I'm driving a hybrid racing car. I never thought that was going to happen, but here we are, four-wheel drive hybrid now, very similar systems to that of Formula One of today, which we've had for a few years now at Toyota. So, yeah, there's a lot going on inside the car. Lots of extra controls to deal with. And now we're coping with the fuel flow meter. Again, the same processes as the Formula One guys having to cope with. It makes your life pretty busy behind the wheel. Most of it's given to you by the engineer, most of the instructions. But you're free to have a bit of a play as well with things like the fly-by-wire brake system.
So straight away, let's talk about that. Fly-by-wire, I'm used to it in throttles. Most of our listeners will be. I've got a motorbike that's got ride-by-wire. There's no physical connection in terms of an old-fashioned cable between the twist grip on the right-hand side of my BMW and the fuel injection. But brake-by-wire, that's getting a bit serious.
Yeah, it's best not to think about it too much, I guess. It's why engineers are engineers and drivers are drivers. I think if we knew too much, I think we wouldn't step foot in them. But it's very safe.
The reason behind it is we're not just talking about braking with brake discs and brake pads going onto those brake discs anymore. So it's a much more involved process.
Yeah, there's a conjunction now between the rear motor, torque motor, which converts obviously the kinetic energy that you use to brake and produces electricity into the capacitor that we run. The other cars out there, you know, the Audi with the flywheel system, that generates obviously the energy through there, and then Porsche have the lithium-ion batteries which store their energy. So we've all got very different systems, but on our car it's very powerful through the kinetic energy at least. We don't have the turbo system to feed it as well during a straight line, so all of our recovery is done purely by our left foot. Or right foot, I guess, for those that still use that for braking. But it is complex. They work in conjunction, the mechanical system and the rear torque motor. And you do get some situations where when you saturate the system, the electric system, when it's full of charge, you then revert to the mechanical system on the rear brakes.
Now, who does that? Do you do that? Does the system make that decision? Boy, there's a wry smile on the face of Davidson here.
It's magic. That's all it can be, John.
There's not a little graph that tells you, you know, do something. I mean, do you even talk about brake bias anymore? What are we talking about?
Yeah, we really do. I mean, a lot of our meetings now, I mean, in the old days, it used to be about springs and dampers and ride heights and aero.
Caster, camber, rebound.
Absolutely. We don't really talk about that anymore. That's all done on the simulation tools that they have. Two of our drivers were on the driver sim before coming here. I think it was Stefan and Kazuki did some days at TMG before coming here. And, you can, from that, you get an idea on the aerodynamics, the gear ratios, everything put in place. But the thing that you really, the small details that you need to put in place at the track are the fuel strategy, The brake bias, which can change even by wind direction. Yeah. You know, say if you've got a tailwind later on going into turn one, we'll be quickly monitoring that on the wheel. We've got a brake shift, which sends a migration either forwards or rearwards on our braking as you go deeper into the corner. And we've also got...
Whoa, hang on. So this is effectively active brake bias through the braking period into a corner?
Yeah, because it's electronic, it basically allows you to do whatever you want with the brakes, apart from corner-dependent, obviously, that's against the rules. But either end of the car can be transferred front or rear or vice versa. Wow. So we can go into a corner thinking, when we first hit the brakes, wow, that was a lot of front locking. So at that moment, you'll adjust the standard brake bias, which is electronically governed as well. But because it's electronically governed, it's a constant true percentage that you're always fixed with. There's no migration at all in cable twist or whatever you would have had or the master cylinders, you know, anything like that. So it's a true pedal all the time. So you get very little modulation feeling through the brake pedal. So that was quite strange to get used to. A bit like in an F1 car, the clutch, for instance, you know, it's just a paddle, just a switch, and you have no physical contact really with what's going on in behind you. But yeah, that makes it quite dampened in a way. The drivers feel when you press these switches or controls on the car nowadays. But yeah, the brakes are fascinating, you know, in these cars. Now they're so powerful, the rear motor can really change the behaviour of the car under braking. So say if you first hit the brake pedal, like I said, you might have a huge amount of rear locking. At that moment, you'll say, well, okay, next lap around, I'll go forward on the brake bias for that one particular corner. But later on in the corner, you might get front locking as you turn into the corner and the front would unload.
Yeah.
So in the old days, you just have to put up with it, really, or change your style slightly. Well, now you can say, well, actually, you know, the thinking driver can say, well, actually, I don't like the way it's doing that, locking up the front as I approach the corner. So I'll use the brake migration tool to send it rearward slightly when I get close to the apex. But it's up to you to decide how much you go. And then you've got to obviously revert it back to the next corner.
And how are you doing that? Are you doing that in real time with a control, or do you preset that into each corner? Sorry, I'm getting really normy here, but I'm fascinated by this, and our listeners will be as well.
No, it's a fascinating system, and you know, again, it's in line with the F1 guys. They're going through this as well, and we'll talk about this heavily in the debriefs. Between the three drivers, well, that's where it gets complicated, because different drivers, different styles. So you'll jump in the car sometimes after your teammate, and it's all over the place. The brake bias and the shift.
You don't get one of those little buttons like you do in a road car where you can set your seat and your mirrors and everything and your brake bias as well.
Control, delete, reset. So you have to change it back to your preferred settings.
Go back to the original thing. Are you setting that brake migration, as you're calling it, and I love the new vocabulary as well, are you setting that corner by corner as you approach the corner?
Yeah, you will. But you have to program in your brain almost. You do it by memory. What happened the previous lap in that corner? Did it happen more than twice? Was it just a genuine mistake by the driver trying to brake too late?
Yeah.
And then weirdly, a psychological thing happens. When you make a brake adjustment, you tend to sometimes think, right, I've made the adjustment. Now that means I can brake even deeper into the corner. But you're only talking 0.5%, 1% change at a time. So it's not huge. But in your mind, can sometimes you're looking for the answer, you know, a quick fix to your problems. And it might be more complex than that. And
that's a switch on the steering wheel, and or something on the dashboard.
It's controls that are easy access. They're two rotors on the thumbs, either side, and we've got the numbers on there, of course. So we memorise which number we preferred for when we were in the car. But then, as the brakes genuinely wear as well, that can shift your brake bias sometimes, and the power of the shift tool that you have. So as the race goes on, in the old days you'd feel a longer pedal, and you get you're so in tune with the brakes in a mechanical system, but now the pedal always stays the same. So when you've got tired brakes, say end of their life at Le Mans, for instance, they've done 23 hours and they're still going, we know that the brakes will be, or they should be feeling like a long spongy pedal at that point, but we don't. We don't feel that in our car. So we know that we might have to make some compromises with the brake bias adjust and all that.
It sounds to me like, and you're probably too young to remember this, when I first started listening to Radio Luxembourg on medium wave on a night time, and you tune into 208 metres medium wave, but it would kind of drift a bit, and you'd be constantly just slightly doing, it used to be called a fine tune on your radio, and you'd be fine tuning up and down in between songs, sometimes during songs. This is a similar sort of thing that you're doing corner to corner as the fuel load comes off, and certainly if you're something like a wing angle, or you change the nose or something like that.
Yeah, you know, track evolution as well can change the balance of a car.
Second stint of a tyre.
Absolutely. So you've got to be on it all the time. But it's nice that we can, like I say, if you've got the capacity as a driver to think about what you're doing when you're out there and process it and then make an action from that feeling, then it's great. It rewards the drivers that are really thinking their way around the lap now.
That's just one aspect. That's the braking aspect that we've been talking about there. And we're talking about you playing with 1,000 horsepower under your right foot nowadays with this TSO40. The other things that you've got to be thinking about, and we still haven't got onto the actual racing part of it, by the way, dear listener, is your fuel numbers. Now, we've always driven to fuel numbers in sports car racing to a greater or lesser degree, whether it's been set this lap time and hit the delta every lap, whether it has been a fuel number in terms of how much you've used. But that's even more important nowadays, and there is an element of the car telling you if you're doing something wrong now.
Yeah, fuel tuning is obviously another huge thing that we talk about these days. A lot of our meetings are meeting times taken up by perfecting the fuel cuts that we have around the lap. There's obviously an optimum what the simulation tool would suggest, but it can never feel the traffic situation, the flow of the track as well as a driver can. So we're constantly tuning that. And on a day like today where we've had a wet start to the morning, you know, if qualifying is dry later on, then there'll be some teams out there really struggling to have optimised the fuel strategy cut in time. And the last thing you want is it to go over the limit, otherwise you throw away your lap times.
Yeah.
You're not allowed to, in qualifying especially, to go over even one lap over the fuel limit.
We've seen on the onboards the blue light in your car. That's your fuel warning.
Yeah, we have three lights as a countdown as to when it's going to cut for us. We could have no lights at all and it would just cut for you, but that it's a bit strange.
And is that literally lifting off the throttle for you, Ant?
Yeah, it does. It's just a lift-off.
Momentarily, for half a second, or is it like, you know, on some video games, if you go off the track, it goes, oh, you've gone off the track. 5, 4, 3, 2. When you go, oh, come on.
Best one is that I can think of is Outrun, the old computer game. It's like that. It's like, you just, come on, you're making it to the line and you get regeneration of power. That's what it's like. It takes away your power. It does the fuel cut, and you just have to sort of sail along. It's lift and coasting, which I guess they've always done in Le Mans to save a bit of fuel. It's the fastest way to take a racing car around a lap if you're looking at fuel load as well, and if you're trying to eke it out for an extra lap at Le Mans. I've done it in the past in the Peugeot days, you know, lifting off and coasting. The boys and girls in IRL have been doing it for ages, especially on the ovals, I guess. To try and save that extra bit of fuel towards the end of the race. So that hasn't changed in principle from where it's been in the past. It's just that now they're able to govern it very accurately through the software and the fuel flow meters. So it takes away in many ways a lot of pressure from the driver to have to constantly think about it and monitor the situation. It does it for us now. So that's good, but only when it's working well. The tuning of it, however, comes from the driver, and that's the difficult part. So in the same way that you tune brake bias now, traction control, and the general setup of the car, we're now tuning where it cuts the fuel for us as well.
And ideally, of course, much like anti-lock brakes, you want to be on the very edge of that cut without it doing it for you. That's the same with anti-lock brakes. I've only ever driven a race car once, 1 year, Carrera Cup cars had anti-lock brakes, and I got to drive one at Brands, and I hated every moment of it. And then I was told, don't get into the ABS. Well, it's the same thing with this fuel cut. If you're right on the edge of it doing it, but it's not doing it, then clearly you're doing something right.
To be honest, it's not. It doesn't really take away that much. And I was really pleased in Silverstone, the first time I've actually raced it, I was pleased that I could still drive how I always have.
Right.
I didn't really have to care about fuel saving at all. You know, I could keep my foot flat if I wanted, but the system would lift for you. And it didn't in any way at all affect my racing. And I was really relieved and pleased about that.
And I think the fans will be delighted to hear that. Now, the other side of that, of course, is the hybrid. And the hybrid giving you that 1,000 horsepower, but also filling in some of those gaps. Like you said, you don't have a turbo. You don't have that oomph of power that Porsche and Audi have. But you do have it from the EV system. And 1,000 horsepower is a lot of ponies, whichever way you look at it. And when that runs out, what does that feel like?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very powerful system. We feel it a lot. We do feel like we have a genuine 1,000 or close to 1,000 horsepower. But, yeah, it stops pretty quickly. And it's only a sad thing when you're in the car, when you feel the 400-odd horsepower leave you. Yeah, and it really does drop away. You watch on the right-hand side, we've got a control panel that shows us the state of charge. And we watch it filtering down from wherever it is, near 100% down to zero. And when it gets to zero, you really feel it, and you're back to 500-odd horsepower, I say only.
I was going to say, you're still accelerating at that point in some cases, I would expect, but the rate of acceleration has slowed down. Do you actually feel that, you know, it's not going to throw you onto your belt as if somebody had break the car, but you must feel that.
Well, it's like I was saying, the most efficient way around a racetrack in a racing car is to catapult yourself onto the straight line, especially when it's a very long straight line that you're coming onto. Take La Source at Spa, for instance, and you count Eau Rouge in the dry as part of the straight, it should be full throttle. So you catapult out of the corner as fast as you can, a bit like on a road bike, getting out of the seat and standing up and pedalling for all your might to get up to a cruising speed. Or an aeroplane taking off from the right, 100% power to get the thing into the air. Once you're at cruising speed, you can throttle back. So that's exactly the same process we're going through in the car. You get up to terminal velocity as fast as you can, and then you can start thinking about the fuel saving and having a little drag on the car as possible.
Do you have to do much with that, or is that again coming from the software? Obviously, the preparation of it, and I thought it was interesting what you said about the fuel flow. Whilst there's automated systems at work here, as always, the work goes in beforehand because you've got to fine tune it.
Yeah, we're putting in the groundwork before the system is perfect, and we just rely on the system. The software simulation tools aren't quite accurate enough yet. They probably will be in the future. They're not quite accurate yet to just switch it on automated system and go out and go and forget about it. But we were talking about the boost and how powerful it is on the acceleration. The complication this year is that we're four-wheel drive boost, so we're harvesting not through just the rear brakes like last year, but the front as well. And the rear motor is still more powerful than the front, but it's amazing to have four-wheel drive, genuine four-wheel drive boost from EV boost on the exit of corners, and feeling it for the first time just now in the wet. It was the first time I've ever driven the car in the wet to exit the final chicane here at Spa, turn 19, and feel that increased traction from what we had last year is amazing, and we feel it's a big benefit to us in the rain. But it goes very quickly, and I've noticed on the circuit that the Porsche is perhaps able to boost not quite at the same intensity, but for longer. Yeah. And it's really fascinating to see the differences of the technology out there.
You guys charge your supercapacitor up before you go out of the pits?
We can charge in the pit lane, but we can do the entire distance of the pit lane on EV if we want.
Yeah.
So that's pretty cool. It's got quite a big range, really, when you think about how much power it's kicking out. But the beauty of our system is that it can recharge in an instant. In the dry, under heavy braking, when you've got a lot of, especially if you've got a lot of downforce on, say, somewhere like Silverstone, you come to a heavy braking zone, you watch the charge rate just increase from 0 to 100% in a matter of seconds.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. So it charges as quickly as it depletes. And that's the difference between a supercap compared to a lithium-ion battery.
And from a driver's point of view, that's great, because that means you're not waiting. And we've heard other people with other systems talking about, well, it takes two corners, it takes three corners before we get full use of the system again. Not the case with the TSO40.
No, like I said, everything is done through recovery on the brakes. We do have the opportunity to charge to use petrol to charge your the capacitor, but that's not the most efficient way to go around the lap. But say, like, under safety car situations or down the pit lane, we have that available to us. But yeah, it's an incredible system. When you just touch the brake pedal, you watch it charge pretty much instantaneously. And that's the advantage of a supercap. The disadvantage is its transportation around the lap, I guess, of the harvest. It wants to store the energy really quickly and get rid of it quick. It lends itself brilliantly to a racetrack. But say charging it up for a qualifying lap, for instance, where there's no more we can do. We 100% is 100% for us, and it's gone in a couple of seconds. Where say, like, the Porsche, for instance, with lithium-ion batteries, they can transport that energy elsewhere on the lap for later on and use it in one big chunk, for instance, on the exit of La Source, perhaps. They might give an extra little boost going up Eau Rouge. Who knows? I mean, they have a bit more freedom, albeit less boost, but like I said before, more range in many ways. So it's interesting to understand all this technology as a driver.
Let's break away from the technology for the final question here and take you back a couple of weeks to Silverstone. The fans watching trackside on TV, and us guys watching on the TV pictures as well, were amazed at the visual speed of the cars. We're using 25 to 30% less carbon fuel. The lap times are as quick, if not quicker. The terminal velocities are as quick, if not quicker. It seems the cornering speeds are as quick, if not quicker. You're dealing with certainly the GT cars in the early part of the straights easier than I've ever seen it happen before. And that's not a bad thing, is it?
It's much safer this year because we're catching them quicker. It's like the old days in the V12 Peugeot. You know, we feel like we're in a different category. Whereas 2 years ago, it really felt like...
Everything was happening between turning and apex, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, we were having to rely on momentum around the corners to get the job done, basically, to overtake a GT car. Now, we are clearly in a different category, and we can just sail past in a straight line, nice and safe. Yes, of course, we will always try and take risks around corners when you come up against the GT cars, but at least we know we've got the boost now on the exit of corners to deal with the problem straight away. So I feel there's less pressure in the car to carry momentum to get the overtaking work done. So, yeah, it's... And I still reckon this was part...
Looked great from on board, by the way.
Oh, really? Okay, yeah, good. I'm glad it looked good for people watching. It feels good in the car. Yeah. And I still think that if we had had the cars as they are now, my Le Mans crash probably wouldn't have happened, because the closing speed would have been much faster, and I would have been past. And I was still used to the closing speeds from 2011, and in 2012 we took a big hit. So that it does affect the way the driver feels and approaches traffic in a race, definitely. So I'm interested that you've spotted that as well, because I feel that it's now we're clearly in a different class, which is a good thing. But the thing, the reason for that, I guess, is because we're free to use the fuel how we want. So that means you could have 2,000 horsepower if you wanted, but you know, it's not very good for fuel efficiency. So the limitation being fuel is fascinating to see how they're dealing with that. And I guess, like I said before, the best way around it is to blast yourself onto the straight as quickly as possible, and then deal with the fuel efficiency at the end of the straight.
But real racing, Ant, that was the thing everyone was worried about. Oh, all this technology, we're all in fuel saving, it's going to be an economy run. Silverstone's a fast track. It wasn't that at all.
1,000 horsepower doesn't sound like an economy run to me, but yeah, obviously we've got the systems in place now. We're running our capacitor at full capacity, whereas we couldn't do that in the past because of the regulations. We were, in a way, I always felt it was really bizarre that they put a cap on green. Like, why would you do it? Why would you handicap greenness? You know, we had this amazing system that was capable of much, much more storage than what we were allowed to use. but there was a cap on it from the regulation. So now at least we're free to use it however we want, and that's why we've seen increased speeds, in straight line speed especially. Drag has obviously had to come down because of the fuel saving implications. But I'm surprised we're so close, to be honest, to the lap times of the past, because the car in the corner, at least, doesn't feel anywhere near as good as last year's car.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. Silverstone was a big shock, a big come down in grip compared to last year. But
smaller tyres as well, of course.
Yeah, yeah. Narrow tyres, narrower car width, 100mm narrower than last year, so less scope for aero in a way. And, yeah, some big cuts on aero through the regulations, but still, we're going pretty much as fast, so... Yeah,
Maggots Beckett's looked just unbelievable from the low camera, and anybody who was standing on the bank side thought it was mega. Listen, I know you're a busy man. Thank you very much indeed. Can we just finally just say it? It's still flat, even though you're in the low downforce spec, it's still flat up Eau Rouge in the dry.
I'll tell you later. Yeah. Hopefully you won't see me in the barriers trying.
This programme is a Radio Show Limited production. For more, go to www.radiolemon.com. Radio Show Limited. We talk to the world.